Until yesterday, no chairman of the Federal Reserve had ever given a full-fledged news conference. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke broke with that tradition. The simple fact that the event took place was the big news. Still, as NPR's John Itzde reports, the gathering did yield several interesting nuggets.
Chairman Bernanke conducted the press conference from a desk on a raised dais in a Fed conference room. He looked a bit like the former professor he is, fielding questions from a class numbering about 60, in this case reporters, not students. Bernanke explained why his Fed had chosen to communicate in this way.
I personally have always been a big believer in providing as much information as you can to help the public understand what you're doing, to help the markets understand what you're doing, and to be accountable to the public for what you're doing.
The Fed chairman spent much of the rest of the press conference explaining the balancing act the Fed is engaged in. It's trying to stimulate the economy and bring down unemployment through low interest rates and a second round of quantitative easing, the bond-buying program that's injecting money into the economy. It's nicknamed QE2. At the same time, the Fed is carefully watching to make sure those policies don't spark inflation. Many economists say the QE2 stimulus hasn't worked. Bernanke disagreed, saying it's boosted economic activity, job growth, and the stock market. But he made clear there's unlikely to be a QE3, another round of stimulus, because of a rising risk of inflation.
It's not clear that we can get substantial improvements in payrolls without some additional inflation risk. And in my view, if we're going to have success in creating a long-run, sustainable recovery with lots of job growth, we've got to keep inflation under control.
Bernanke and the Fed's policymaking committee acknowledged yesterday that rising commodity prices, including the rising price of oil, are boosting inflation. They said, however, they believe the price rises are transitory and that inflation will return to lower levels. The added focus on inflation risks caught the attention of Tim Dewey, a University of Oregon professor who writes a blog called Tim Dewey Fed Watch.
He came off to me a little bit more hawkish in some of those statements than I would have anticipated.
But that hawkishness or willingness to take action to raise interest rates was not evident in yesterday's statement from the Fed's Open Market Committee. The committee repeated again that it expects short-term interest rates to remain exceptionally low, that is, near zero, for an extended period. Bernanke was asked to define what an extended period means.
Extended period suggests that there would be a couple of meetings probably before action, but unfortunately, the reason we use this vaguer terminology is that we don't know with certainty how quickly response will be required.
Randall Krosner, a former Fed governor, who is now a professor at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business, says that's useful news for investors.
I think it's valuable that the chairman gave a little bit more information about what he meant by extended period and that it would mean at least two meetings. That's about 12 weeks. That's about 3 months. So that's a useful signal to the market. That's probably the most newsworthy thing that happened.
At the end of his historic press conference, Chairman Bernanke offered some sympathy to Americans suffering from economic woes.
The combination of high unemployment, high gas prices, and high foreclosure rates is a terrible combination. A lot of people are having a very tough time, so I can certainly understand why people are impatient.
But the Fed chairman offered little hope of additional stimulus to further speed the recovery. That's not likely to give much consolation to the millions of Americans who remain unemployed. For many, their future is coldly predicted in the Fed's forecast for unemployment. It projects an unemployment rate still around 7% 2.5 years from now. John Itzde, NPR News, Washington.
On President Obama's slate today at the White House, a meeting with the president of Panama. They talked about a new trade agreement, one of three such deals the administration is working on, in a push to double U.S. exports. NPR's Scott Horsley has a progress report.
The White House inherited the three trade agreements with Panama, South Korea, and Colombia from the Bush administration. And at first, Mr. Obama had reservations about all of them. Late last year, though, South Korea agreed to revise its treaty, offering better terms for U.S. automakers. And this month, Panama agreed to provide stronger labor protections and to help the U.S. crack down on tax evaders. As a result, U.S. Trade Representative Ron Kirk says the administration is now ready to move forward with these two deals.
These are good, solid agreements now. They each have the opportunity to add billions of dollars to our exports and help support thousands of new jobs at a time many Americans are still desperate to find employment.
The Colombian trade agreement has also moved forward, but not as far. Protection of labor rights is the biggest stumbling block. Kirk says the Colombian government has agreed to a plan to improve labor protections that could pave the way for a deal down the road. Colombia is one of the biggest markets in Latin America, so would-be exporters like wheat farmer Gordon Stoner are anxious to see that deal move forward.
Exports are just critical to my profitability and continued operation of the farm.
Stoner farms about 11,000 acres in northeastern Montana, just a few miles from the Canadian border. Canada has its own trade deal with Colombia, so Stoner's northern neighbors will soon be selling their wheat there duty-free, while he and other American farmers are facing tariffs of 15%.
I'm willing to compete with any farmer anywhere, but we've got to have a level playing field. And if one country is able to import duty-free and we are not, we're at a disadvantage right out of the gate.
U.S. manufacturers could be at a similar loss. That's why Vice President John Murphy of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce wants the White House and Congress to act quickly on all three of the free trade deals.
On trade, when you stand still, you fall behind.
President Obama's efforts to move forward with the trade agreements puts him at odds with some of his traditional supporters in organized labor. Thea Lee of the AFL-CIO says her union has a respectful disagreement with the White House about the potential for economic benefits, and she says the Colombian pact is particularly controversial.
Colombia has one of the worst records in the world in terms of violence against trade unionists. There have been almost 3,000 murders of trade unionists over the last 20 years or so.
Lee says the Obama administration should take its time and make sure Colombia's new action plan on labor rights is really working before signing any long-term trade deal. House Republicans are already growing impatient. They want the three trade agreements considered together this summer. But Michigan Congressman Sandy Levin, the top Democrat on the Ways and Means Committee, says only the Korean and Panama deals are ripe for congressional action.
Colombia is a work in progress, and so it's a mistake to tie them together. Each of these should be on their own merits.
Ambassador Kirk says he understands Republicans' desire for fast action on all the trade pacts, but he warns moving too quickly could backfire, further eroding Americans' confidence in the benefits of trade.
Many Americans, frankly, still believe that trade is not a vehicle by which the United States can compete and win in terms of job creation.
Kirk thinks the administration can change those attitudes, but only if it's allowed to push the trade agreements on its own timetable. Scott Horsley, NPR News, The White House.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Gaddafi's brutal regime has affected Libya's literature as well. Some of its finest novelists write veiled narratives filled with allegory and a kind of Baroque symbolism. Hisham Matar is one novelist who's chosen to take on the repression directly, both in his critically acclaimed first novel and now his new one, Anatomy of a Disappearance. We reached him at his home in London. Hisham Matar says when Muammar Gaddafi first came to power as a revolutionary liberator, he ushered in a brief golden age of literature, a golden age that ended completely and suddenly in the late 1970s.
In one year, he imprisoned a huge number of writers. They were almost kind of trapped. You know, the revolutionary committee set up a sort of big literary festival, if you like. And then they just captured all the writers, they tortured them, and they put them in prison. And that generation of writers spent minimum 10 years in prison. I know people who've been in prison for 15 years just because their only crime is that they're a novelist or a poet or a short story writer.
So Gaddafi set up a sort of trap. He actually put on the festival in order to round up the writers?
Yes, but he also sent trucks. For example, I remember as a young boy, all these beautiful bookshops in Tripoli, army trucks went to them with lists of books that the regime had decided were not appropriate, and these books were gathered up and burnt in the Green Square. So writers have for a long time been problematic for the regime. Dictatorship, by its essence, is interested in one narrative, an intolerant narrative, and writers are interested in a multiplicity of narratives and conflicting empathies and what the other is thinking and feeling. And that completely unsettles the dictatorial project.
Your own writing is much more forthright about political experiences than some others. Both of your novels deal with a political disappearance. And I wonder if that is inspired, it certainly is similar to something in your own life, and that is that your father was kidnapped in Cairo 21 years ago and has been missing ever since.
You're right in the sense that what has happened to my father, who was a political dissident who was tortured, imprisoned, and then disappears in the political prisons in Libya, so we continue not to know whether he's alive or dead. When somebody dies, it's final, or at least to us it seems final. But when somebody disappears, the possibility of them existing in the same moment, in the same day, the same year, under the same moon, under the same sun, is a very vivid possibility. And what it does to the nature of the grief is uniquely different from the nature of the grief and longing when somebody dies. And so I wanted to try to make something hopefully beautiful from this, which on some level to me, doing that, in other words, being able to sing about the terrible things, to me is an act of resistance. It is a way to say, I will make art even out of this.
You wrote in the first days of these protests in March about the fact that one of the early effects of those protests was the release of prisoners. And among them was your uncle and your two cousins, who had been in prison since 1990. What was the first thing that your uncle said to you?
Actually, the first thing that my uncle said to me when I spoke with him over the phone was, what's this I hear about you being shortlisted for the Booker Prize? So my uncle was keen to remind me that he was connected to the world. And then we talked for a long time because he was in the car being driven home. So we talked for about an hour. And there was this wonderful portion of our conversation in which every sentence he said started with, do you remember? And, you know, it was a marvelous proof, you know, his humor, his ability to remember all these wonderful details when I was young, how he used to push my bike, how the sort of cinnamon hot drinks I liked when I was a kid, and all of these things that he remembered just reminded me how, you know, there's only so much you can do to a man. You know, you can do a great deal. You could steal from them time and ability and possibility. But you can't erase that thing, that spirit, you know. And I'm amazed by my uncle Mahmoud Matar, because he is speaking about forgiveness and he's speaking about, you know, reconciliation. And it's a marvelous thing. I think it's wonderful.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Hisham Matar's latest novel, Anatomy of a Disappearance, comes out in the U.S. this summer.
I'm Michelle Norris.
I'm Melissa Block, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
An unapologetically brash Hollywood blockbuster races into theaters this weekend.
Chances are, sooner or later, we're going to end up behind bars or buried in a ditch somewhere. But not today.
Fast cars, fast women, sun-kissed backdrops. Fast 5 is the fourth sequel in the hugely successful Fast and Furious franchise. The films do not charm most critics, but one of them, Wesley Morris, calls the series the most progressive force in Hollywood. He's a film critic for the Boston Globe, and he joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Now, progressive, that's an interesting term. It's not a word that you would naturally hear attached to a bang-em-up speed flick, so make your case.
Well, basically the thing that I'm most interested in with this series is that it promotes race as this very normal thing. And around these cars are these very different types of people, but it's not the subject of the movie the way it is in most Hollywood movies. Race is just a matter of fact. It is not the way people conduct their business. It is not a cause of friction. It just people happen to be Asian, Hispanic, Black, white. Doesn't matter. They just really want to steal the cars and catch the people who've stolen them.
And by race, you're talking about sort of a multi-ethnic approach in the casting, the packaging, and the marketing.
Everything. I mean, it's not just multiracial. It's interracial. It's polyracial. Race has just kind of exploded into such a thing in these movies that it almost doesn't even matter.
So does this happen naturally? Is it sort of organic, or is it much like Sesame Street or High School Musical, where it looked like this was just sort of this natural multi-ethnic environment, but behind the scenes, there are a lot of people who were carefully making these decisions in order to reach out to a specific audience?
I think initially it seemed that way. I mean, Vin Diesel's production company is called One Race Productions or One Race Films, and I think that he is one of those people who's frequently kind of annoyed by having to deal with and answer questions about, what are you? What background are you? And I think that one of the things he wants to try to do with these movies, whether consciously or not, in achieving that effect, is to sort of eliminate race as a point of conflict and use race as a point of normalcy, which I think is a really revolutionary thing to be able to try to do and achieve in a movie that's made almost, by the time this fifth movie opens, it'll be well over $1 billion at the box office.
These films are not exactly, shall we say, deep?
They're not.
There's a lot of fast cars, and there's not, exactly nuanced social commentary. And in fact, The Onion did a recent spoof that we should listen to before we go on. Let's take a quick listen.
We're so excited to welcome one of Hollywood's brightest creative talents, the screenwriter behind this summer's blockbuster, the new Fast and the Furious movie, Fast 5. Chris Morgan, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Chris. Now, Chris, these Fast and the Furious movies are just getting bigger and better. So when you sat down to write this installment, were there certain elements you wanted to include?
I want the cars to drive fast and then some of them explode.
Oh, that sounds so great. Now,
so what you're hearing there is a child saying, I wanted the cars to go fast and then to explode, which is essentially what happens over and over and over again in these films.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, I think that there's a degree to which the infantile aspect of the way the movies are laid out serves a really interesting corollary to how this race thing functions. I mean, the audience who sees this movie is not going to leave this movie saying, wow, it was so awesome to see all those people of color just hanging out like normal. That's their life. There's nothing to talk about. It's taken for granted. That's just the way it is. But to Hollywood, I think, I can't overemphasize enough how unique that is, where The Blind Side, for instance, is a movie that made well over $200 million, but it's also a movie that's in many ways about the way we tend to see race in America after 100 years of movies.
And we were talking about the story of a white Southern woman who takes in a homeless and very large Black young man who winds up playing on the football team.
You would think the story would be about him and having a bad mother and being virtually homeless and not having any options, and this woman comes into his life. But the movie is actually about the woman and how good it is that she's brought this kid into her life. It's a vehicle for her goodness. And sort of by extension, it tells the story of the history of race in Hollywood. It fosters a very sort of familiar liberal idea, which is that I, white person, will make myself feel better by bringing you, Black person, into my life.
You know, there are a lot of people who are interested in seeing more nuanced or sort of more multidimensional portrayals of people of color on screen. And to them, Fast 5 is, why they applaud the success, it is also somewhat of a disappointment because the women are always clad in bikinis and because, the characters are not, they do not necessarily come across as particularly deep or intellectual.
That's a fair criticism. I just feel like all the characters are shallow, not just the women, and all the characters are hot, not just the women, and all the characters have their clothes off, not just the women. It's an equal opportunity shallow here, and I do think that there is a huge dearth of movies that deal with race seriously, but I don't know. I mean, I feel like this movie's a huge success for treating race as something we deal with every day. And I think that part of the popularity of this series is that it looks like the world that a lot of the people who pay money to see this these movies, it looks like the world they live in. And that isn't ever really the case in most Hollywood movies, even in 2011.
Wesley Morris, thanks so much. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, Michelle.
That's Wesley Morris. He's a film critic for the Boston Globe.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, the big wedding is tomorrow. You know, the one. But planning a wedding can be stressful for mere commoners. Acclaimed graphic novelist Adrian Tomina tells us about the trials and tribulations of planning his wedding. He's written a new memoir about it, and he'll tell you about it in a few minutes. But first, it's hard to believe that April is almost over. Sadly, this means our series, Muses and Metaphor, is coming to an end. As part of our celebration of National Poetry Month this month, we've been broadcasting poems, 140 characters or less, that listeners and friends of the program have posted on Twitter. We've had hundreds of responses, and we've aired tweets from all over the country, from Neptune, New Jersey, to Dallas, Texas, and Palo Alto, California. When we started the series, we enlisted the help of poet Holly Bass. She is a writer and poet in residence for Busboys and Poets. That's a group of restaurants and gathering places here in the Washington, D.C. area. And it's a popular gathering spot for poets and writers to share their work. She's been our series curator, which is to say she's been going through the hundreds of submissions we've received to help us pick the ones to record and put on the air. And Holly Bass joins us now one last time for now in our Washington, D.C. studios. Welcome. It's so sad.
Oh, hi. It's great to be back, though.
But it's been a good series. I mean, I think people have really enjoyed it.
I think it's been excellent. I've been totally impressed by the diversity and by the quality of the type of tweets. And a lot of people have sent in multiple poems. And so it's really cool.
One of the things that I've been really moved by is that, of course, we've heard from many people who are professional writers, editors, bloggers, poets. And of course, we appreciate that. But we also heard from a retired dentist, a financial manager, the provost at Landmark College in Vermont, the past national president of Penn Women, a former lacrosse athlete from Virginia Tech. And I'm just wondering what you think that says.
Well, for me, it really reminds me of one of my favorite American poets, Walt Whitman, and his poem, I Hear America Singing. And it's the boatman, and it's the mason, the carpenter, the young mother. And he lists all these professions. And I really think that just sort of captures that American ethos and democratic spirit that, oh, you don't have to be, you know, in this ivory tower on top of a mountain writing poetry. We can all write poetry.
I also wanted to ask you about the form that we chose, the tweet poem, 140 characters or less. I have to tell you, I was a little nervous about this at first because even though there are poetry forms like haiku that are traditionally brief, you know, I just wondered whether we would really get the kind of the richness. And I've been favorably impressed by just how delicious and evocative many of these poems have been, even at that length.
You know, as someone in journalism, you know it's easier to write long than to write short. And it's the same thing with poetry. And what I notice, though, is often the very best tweeted poems were excerpts of longer poems. So when I would verify that the poem was original, I'd find the full-length poem somewhere on the blog or on another website. And I was like, ah, okay. So it still requires craft. It's not something you should walk down the street and just type into your phone. I think you need to kind of write it down a few times and move the words around. But you can definitely get a lot in just a very few short words.
And since we are down to our last 2 days, we are going to play two new tweets today, try to squeeze in as many as we can before the end of the month. And let's begin with a tweet from Angie Chuang of Washington, D.C. She is a former reporter. Now she teaches journalism at the American University School of Communication. That's in Washington, D.C. Let's listen.
This is Angie Chuang, and this is my tweet. The bullfrogs crick croak tonight. Bubbles of want escaping slick amphibious gullets. Requiem for hunger.
As we said, these poems are short, only 140 characters, so let's play it again.
The bullfrogs crick croak tonight. bubbles of want escaping slick amphibious gullets. Requiem for hunger.
I didn't think I would like a poem about frogs, but I do. Tell me what you liked about this one. Why did you select this one?
Well, I think what she does, the language itself kind of has a texture. So that slick amphibious gullets, it sounds sticky and gooey and oozy and these bubbles of want escaping. And so I just liked the sort of texture and sound of it. And yeah, I'm not a big fan of bullfrogs either, but I liked, you know, the real visceral quality of it.
I'm speaking with writer and poet Holly Bass. She's been helping us pick the poetic tweets that we've been recording and putting on the air as part of our celebration of National Poetry Month. Okay, we have one more tweet from Nishe Pendleton of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. She is a PhD student at Temple University in the Department of African American Studies. She's in the dissertation stage. She's looking at socio-behavioral factors of HIV susceptibility among African American women. Let's listen to her tweet.
This is Nishe Pendleton. And this is my tweet. Oh, my solitude, your name is dissertation, growing day by day.
You can really understand that one. Okay. As we said, these are short. Let's hear it again.
Oh, my solitude, your name is dissertation, growing day by day.
Now, this was a little different because this is very straightforward. In fact, it's interesting that the feedback that we've gotten about some of the poems, I mean, obviously many people just, you know, love them. But then if there are always people who are saying, gee, that's just too deep. I don't understand that one. I think everybody can get this one. What did you like about it?
Oh, well, the meaning is definitely very, very clear. And this is actually a haiku. So it does have the 5-7-5 of the kind of traditional haiku as we're taught in school. And you know, in Twitter world, we would call that a twaiku. So she submitted her twaiku. And I just thought it was really humorous and funny. And it's also the irony of what's growing, the solitude or the dissertation. And both are. So the longer the dissertation gets, the more isolated, you know, she becomes. And I have a number of friends in grad school and they're like, oh, you know. And so I just thought that would be really sweet and fun and something people could relate to.
Well, as we wind down, I want to thank you again, Holly, for helping us curate the series. And I wanted to ask, unfortunately, we won't be airing these beyond tomorrow because tomorrow is the last day of the month, you know, for us. But do you have some thoughts for people who perhaps did not have their poem chosen or who want to keep writing? Any words of inspiration and encouragement for people?
Well, I think that what I do like about the Twitter poetry is that it's not something that requires necessarily hours and hours. And for us to remember that even if you can snatch 5 or 10 minutes from your lunch break and just jot down one line that you like, that can really have a massive impact on you and on others that you share it with. And I'm reminded of the Salvadoran poet Roque Dalton, who said, poetry, like bread, is for everyone. And if we can give ourselves that daily bread of some lyrical beauty in our lives, I encourage that.
Holly Bass is a writer and poet in residence at Busboys and Poets. That's a group of restaurants in the Washington, D.C. area and a popular gathering place for writers and other artists to share their work. She was the curator of Tell Me More's Muses and Metaphor Tweet Poetry Series, and she was here with us in our Washington, D.C. studios one more time. Holly, thank you so much for joining us, and happy National Poetry Month to you.
Thank you, Michelle.
If you missed any of our previous selections and you'd like to hear them, just go to the Tell Me More website, go to npr.org, click on the programs menu and find Tell Me More.